Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a finely sliced selection from a bumper crop of arts and culture across Birmingham and beyond. In this programme, we talk new music, end-of-year reflection and songwriting journeys by way of a catch-up with show regular Dan Whitehouse. We step into an engaging and beautiful capture of childhood and nationhood through a new exhibition by Matthew Krishnu, and we catch folk and roots legend Martin Joseph over a black tea midway through the UK leg of his current tour. If you would like to find out more information on any of the artists featured in the show or stride back through our archive, go to www.switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy. Birmingham-based singer-songwriter Dan Whitehouse is a busy man, currently working up material for a new fifth album, winning awards, touring the country and circling fresh batches of songwriters at the Mac. I managed to pin him down for some inside information and a mince pie. Okay, so I'm with Dan Whitehouse. Dan, we catch up again. We keep bumping into each other, don't we?
We do.
It seems that way. And excitingly, you've got some new music that's just sort of come out, just emerged. So you've got a new EP. Let's start with talking about that. And you've got, I think, quite an intriguing track that leads that. So The State of the English is the track. So let's start with that.
So the new EP was recorded in Stroud with Emily Barker and Lucas Drinkwater at their studio. And it's recorded live in the studio, demos of new material that'll be featured on my new album next year. The song you mentioned, State of the English, is looking at the space in between the consistency that we get from nature and the chaos that we get from our social and political climate.
So it is delving into a very topical concern, let's put it that way. And to be diplomatic, looking at our relationship with the world and others.
This song you're talking about got, perhaps unsurprisingly, really rapturous applause when I recently toured Scotland. It was very well received.
You didn't adapt it to a more Celtic version while you were up there. And the other standout track for me, which I've heard so far from the EP, is Aerial View. And we were talking a little bit earlier about that. And I really kind of captured by that song when I heard it. And like it a lot. And there's some great, I think, backing vocals on it as well, or kind of harmony vocals with is it Harriet Harkins on there? On the track, she sounds great. So we were talking about Aerial View as being a bit about, I suppose, detachment is the word. But do you want to tell us a bit about that track?
So it's about just perspective. You can't control what another does or says or thinks, but it'd be great to be able to just tilt other people's heads sometimes and look at a situation just from a different angle, really. You know, things can appear radically, dramatically different, can't they, at different times of day or night, in different lighting and from different angles. That's what that song's looking at.
And I was saying earlier on that you recorded, I think, quite a really good video, kind of promotional video for that song, Aerial View, in an unusual location in some ways.
Yeah, I found my favourite cafe in Birmingham at Seven Sins in Digbeth, and we recorded it in there with a view of the Screwfix on Digbeth High Road out the window.
You get all the kind of, you know, it's like Hollywood Boulevard, isn't it, when you look out the window? You've got Screwfix and various other industrial
but
icons.
It's a really good vibe in that cafe, and the guy that runs it's really put a lot of thought into it, and it's a good little sanctuary oasis away from the rush, and it was great to have a little spot there to get into the performances that night. We recorded three songs in a night. You can watch those videos on my site.
We'll give some links right at the end so folks can catch up. So the album that these tracks are kind of forming and we'll link to is your fifth album, your fifth studio album, is that right?
That's right.
And that's for Reveal Records?
Yeah.
So how's this fifth album different from the four before it? What makes it distinct?
Well, I took a radically different approach to the writing process. I was conscious that I wanted to write less about myself, and I went in active search of other human stories of interest from across the decades. Stories of people's struggles and injustice and overcoming trauma and found some really interesting stories. I think you always, as a writer, end up bringing your own experiences into the material anyway, and that's largely a positive thing. And then, so I really detached the two processes of music and lyrics. I had some sessions where I was just writing music and vice versa. In the musical sessions, I took inspiration from birdsong and sound from of road traffic and stuff. On there's one song, Tomorrow, where you can hear the A4123 Birmingham New Road. You know, obviously Black Country listeners will be well in tune with that and be able to identify it. But with the birdsong, they sing in a lot of chromatic scales, and I made an effort to notate those accurately, then picked out my favourite little motifs and repeated those and used that as the foundation of new songs. So we recorded hours and hours of instrumental pieces, picked out my favourite sections to make into songs, which was just completely different to, because I was just bored of the same tired chord sequences I was churning out and stuff.
So that sounds quite disciplined in how you've described it. Was there a case of the music was first and then the lyrics, or lyrics the music, or was it a bit of a mixture depending on how the muse took you?
So we had we'd separated some sessions were just the focus was to make music and soundscapes, and then other days my focus would be to write lyrics. And sometimes in the lyric writing process, I wrote sort of sketch melodies, but I didn't hold myself to those initial melodies. It was just as a way to finish writing the songs. Then I would detach the lyrics and then reimagine the melody to the other music pieces that we'd written instrumentally.
Cycle loops, then loops again. Alert tones with eyes closed. You feed the beast inside your phone. Come nightfall, we'll draw masks and cut and paste our selfies in a country divided. And in the end, we'll all remain. The lies, the guilt, the shame, the risk, the hurt, the waste. The library closed their doors, no one noticed, no one sees past their screen. Sharp rolls, it shutters. A stranger curls up in the doorway, sleeping, praying in discarded packaging. The lies, the guilt, the shame, the risk, the hurt, the waste. The library. Close their doors, no one noticed. The lies, the guilt, the shame, the risk, the hurt, the waste. The library closed their doors, no one noticed. No one sees past their screen.
Most recently you had a bit of a celebration, didn't you, in terms of your year gone by, and you did a special show, I think, at New Hampton Arts Centre in Wolverhampton. And that was a kind of looking back and looking forward kind of gig. You were kind of looking back at 2018 and doing a number of things that you've developed and picked up along the way. And you had, I think you had, we should probably say, you had quite a special guest appear as well, didn't you?
Very special. It was. I was honoured to have Boo Hewardine share the stage with me that night. And it was a night of reflection on the year, like you say. And it's been a busy time playing largely solo. And it was nice to have a full band lineup of brilliant musicians playing tracks from across my albums, but playing the new record as well. Played about half of the new record. I think December really, it's what one good thing, isn't it, of December is like that time of reflection. It was really nice to be doing that in my hometown, you know, after all the travelling. A nice warm audience to try out new material that, you know, hadn't played anywhere. So obviously you're a bit nervous playing stuff for the first time.
Some friendly faces, as it were.
Yeah.
Now you've played, and this year you've played a lot of different places all across the map. And you've supported a number of big names, I think, as well. And I was going to ask you about one of those big names, which was Leo Sayer. You did a gig with Leo Sayer. What was that like?
Well, it turned into about 20 gigs around the UK with Leo Sayer. And the great thing about Leo Sayer is that he's really passionate about his new album that he's making. And he's made a brilliant Beatles tribute album that I don't know if he'll ever see the light of the day, but backstage and on the tour bus he was always playing me these new demos and or old recordings he'd sourced of old R&B artists and stuff, and he was telling me about fantastic stories about when he had a jam session with Jimi Hendrix. He was playing harmonica, obviously Hendrix on guitar, and I think they shared a girlfriend at one point. Really, it was an honour to see him perform every night, to see the what his songs meant to his audience and have done consistently over the decades. People go to his shows and they sing along to every word and it means the world to them, and that's a beautiful thing to witness. He's got an incredibly powerful singing voice. I don't know what else to say. His audience were really receptive to my music and I was grateful that he was sharing his audience with me. You know, that was an honour.
It sounds like a good chapter as well for your memoirs when you get to them. Days on the road with Leo Sayer, as it were. Now, also, I think it was in 2018, you won a Birmingham Music Award, is that right? Or was it the year before?
Yeah, it was this year, 2018.
It was this year. So you won an award for Best Folk Country Artist, or Folk Stroke Country Artist.
Yeah.
So that's quite an achievement. That's.
Thank you, James.
Yeah, a gold disc on the wall or something. Yeah. A trophy.
They give you a gong with your name on. It was very kind of them to do that. I was pleased to be nominated and just to be a part of it. It was great to have a ceremony celebrating all the great music that's being made in Birmingham, because there is loads and a lot of it's under the radar. And we had a great celebration at the Glee Club, you know, a venue that means a lot to me. I played at a lot over the years. I'm sure this was the first year of the Birmingham Music Awards. I'm sure it's going to continue to grow and I look forward to attending the ceremony, although obviously don't expect to be nominated again, but it's a great thing to have for Birmingham. Birmingham needs more of this, celebrating the arts.
It's quite an achievement, I think. Let's finish with just talking back, going back to the new album. When can we expect that to emerge, and what's the kind of schedule for release and touring of that?
It'll probably be released in September 2019. There's two sides to it. One is an expansive kind of soundscape with lots of instruments. The other thing is more stripped back song based, like what I do live. And I'm really, we're just putting the finishing touches to it at the moment.
So folks that are eagerly awaiting that album can make use of the EP, as it were, now.
That's right.
You can find that on your website and on Spotify and other places.
No, that EP is only available at my shows.
It's an exclusive to your shows.
They can find my music on Spotify. Anybody that hasn't heard my music before, it's all on Spotify. But the new EP is only, it's a limited thing, a limited run just at the gigs. But come to a gig.
You can definitely come. One more reason to come to a Dan Whitehouse gig, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, but for now, Dan, thanks. Thanks for your time. Thanks for talking to me again. And as ever,
pleasure. Thank
great
you, James.
To catch up properly.
I remember I climbed the tree and days rolled into days. You were waving up at me, shadows stretched out in the haze. I can't explain what I have seen, a blurred out face, blood and tears, a simple loop, one broken dream. don't give up on me. I had to wipe the canvas clean. Can we color the world back in? Live with things we've seen. Things that cannot be unseen. Silence in me all these years. A simple loop, one broken dream. We play for them. We live for them. Till they can play on their own. We play for them. Weave a thread and back again. Through all the damaged song. We live for them.
For more information, music and demos, go to www.dan-whitehouse.com. Now, if you're in need of some dark comedy, Joe Pennell's Blue Orange plays at the Birmingham Rep from Friday the 1st of February to Saturday the 16th of February 2019. It's a sharp take on race and mental health in modern Britain, and we'll be featuring an interview with some of its driving force in the next show. For tickets and further information, go to www.birmingham-rep.co.uk, or you can call the box office on 0121 236 4455. The Sun Never Sets is an exhibition of thoughtful and reflective paintings by London-based artist Matthew Krishnu, which is on at MAC Birmingham until Sunday, the 10th of March. I met up with the artist to explore the dreamlike works, consider his take on growing up in the Bangladesh capital, and I got an in-depth guide to two of the exhibition's featured works. Okay, so I'm here with Matthew Krishnu, and we're here at the MAC, very excitedly, just before the exhibition opens, and the exhibition is The Sun Never Sets, which is a very kind of enigmatic title. And let's perhaps start, Matthew, with explaining some of the themes and some of the things you're exploring. It's kind of, I guess, starts with childhood.
Yeah, the paintings are broadly based on two key figures, myself and my brother, as boys, young boys, growing up in Bangladesh. And in a way, the whole exhibition is kind of a process of world building where they're the main characters, and then the show takes you on a journey through some of the places they've been to, the landscape, the atmosphere, and also the relationship with adults in some of the paintings. The title, The Sun Never Sets relates broadly to the theme of, it comes from an old phrase, that the sun never sets on the British Empire. And so in a way there are like the shadows of empire, if you like, in the paintings as well. There are scenes of a whole series of work called Mission, which involves the missionaries that lived in Bangladesh. And occasionally you'll come across a tourist, say, a European tourist. And I guess the whole show is setting up this relationship between the main characters and who kind of stands out from it, who's different from it.
And you yourself, I think, spent 11 years of your childhood in Bangladesh.
That's right.
Your parents kind of went there to learn and become, not become preachers, but do sort of theological study, is that right?
Yeah, let's take it right back to the beginning. I was born in Bradford. And so, you know, born British, my father's a British man, and my mother's from India. My mother's from India, West Bengal. And both of them had undertaken training around theological training, basically, in Birmingham, actually. And then they got work in Bangladesh, but we didn't have family there. And I guess that's kind of what I mean about the bond that I had with my brother. Having this mixed heritage, having this sort of British heritage, but still, because I was a baby when we moved to Bangladesh, it was home. And in a way, the two of us formed this really strong relationship. Everything is looked at through that lens, I guess. You know, my father was the foreigner, being this white Englishman in Bangladesh, and a priest, no less, a Christian priest. But then we'd be going to services of, you know, Bangladeshi Christians. And I guess the paintings are all about bringing the viewer, any visitor to the gallery, into some of these stories in a way. It's storytelling. It's almost like if I were to write a novel or make a film about these times, I'd have key characters and I'd have these different scenarios. And in a way, I'm just doing that with oil paint.
Now, you mentioned that there's an imperial reference, if you like, throughout. And I wonder if there's a sort of personal nostalgia for yourself in terms of looking back at a time when perhaps you perceived things were golden and a kind of wondrous time in your life, when maybe, perhaps, you know, because of your age and your development, you perhaps didn't see all the kind of sharp edges of things.
I think I love the title, The Sun Never Sets, because it's quite open. Yeah, it refers to that imperial side, but then there's also that sense of when you're young, it feels like when you're young and you're outdoors and you're playing with people you love, it's like the sun never sets. It's like you could be out all day and it feels like an eternity. So there's that. And then there's also the idea that when you paint an image, you're kind of freezing people in paint. You know, the sun never sets in a painting. It's not like a film where you've got time passing. So it's also about freezing these memories, these experiences, and kind of making them eternal. What I would say, though, is it's not so much nostalgia, because I find the subjects as well, there's often kind of an edge to them. I mean, the boys, for a start, don't always look particularly happy. They're in the moment, but you know, in one of the paintings, there are the two boys posing in front of the skeleton of an animal. In others, they might be high up in a tree or on a quite rickety boat. You know, they might be using bows and arrows, firing them. You know, there's a machete in one painting. I guess it's also about sometimes the shadow side of childhood, that it's not always a safe space, you know, that actually feels a little vulnerable. So I'd say it's world building more than a golden age, and a world building that's built around some of the complications as well of childhood.
Now, when folks first come to your work, I think they're perhaps hit by a kind of simplicity, if you like, in terms of there's a very sort of accessible, readily kind of recognised image or scene. But that's deceptive, I think, in some ways, because as you said, you know, the boys in the pictures aren't always happy. But when you sort of explore and immerse yourself in the particular scene or particular piece, there are lots of intricate things going on, aren't there? Lots of, I think you call them complexities.
Yeah, I mean, I spend a lot of time thinking about the composition of a painting. Once I've got, broadly speaking, the composition in mind, then it's questions of scale as well, and that's a big part of it for the visitor experience, the viewer experience, is their relationship. For instance, there's a painting of a swimming pool with just one small figure, just the head and shoulders of a boy peering out of a swimming pool, and it looks like an evening scene. And there's a vulnerability, you know, because it's one figure, it's really small. And then next to it in the exhibition, there's one of these two boys up a tree, and they're higher than the sort of tallest visitor to the exhibition. So you're forced to look up at the two boys. And I think there's one thing about constructing what's within the picture plane, if you like, what's in the composition in terms of, you know, creating these things that I don't necessarily have an answer. I'll put things in, you know, and leave it quite open to the viewer to work out. But then there's also the relationship of the paintings, just in terms of how big they are or small they are in relation to the viewer. And I think all of it relates to the history of painting that I'm always looking at. And, you know, if I paint a scene with a religion in it, I'm thinking about all these Western paintings, you know, whether in Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci, which are essentially religious paintings, but they're always talked about just in terms of art history. But then when I paint religion, I'm not making religious paintings, I'm kind of making a painting about religion in this really specific context. So I'm constantly referring, you know, in the paintings, there are often references to other painters. And I think for me, the fundamental simplification, I think, is often a kind of a difficult thing, because you have to stop at the right point. Because if you get too far in, it starts looking, you know, a lot of these paintings are based on photographs, but I don't want to make photorealist paintings. I also don't want to make paintings that look too much like specific people. I want them to be quite open. So for those reasons, I keep them as simple as I can, but as complex as they need as well.
Now, the exhibition here at MAC is on till 10th of March, and excitedly, in parallel to that, there's an exhibition, A Murder of Crows, at the Icon Gallery in Birmingham. Let's talk a little bit about that. People will think, oh, murder, that's quite, you know, something dastardly is afoot, but A Murder of Crows is the kind of collective noun, isn't it, for a group of crows. Tell us about what the sort of the significance of the crow is.
Yeah, it's the most famous collective noun. I think you also sometimes hear of a horde of crows or even a wake of crows, but they're all pretty sinister. And the crows, I must have, you know what, actually my first crows were painted in Birmingham way back, because I was based in Birmingham 2001 till 2005. And I've always loved just the crow as a mythical symbol, if you like. I mean, certainly in my childhood in Bangladesh, you'd hear and see crows everywhere. You know, it's a constant cacophony of crows, and they'd be picking in the rubbish dumps and, you know, picking out old gizzards and things. See, as a child, you'd be just watching crows wherever you are. And of course, the crows I'm painting are British crows, and in a way that's another window. It's like this thing, it triggers kind of a memory or an atmosphere for me. But then also at university I was reading Ted Hughes's book Crow, wonderful poems, and then the crows have all these history, you know, Edgar Allan Poe's crow, the raven, then there's Gauguin did a famous painting, Nevermore, with a raven in it. And of all other creatures, apart from humans, crows are my next favourite to paint. And I've been painting them, you know, there was a show at the Custard Factory in Birmingham, I think in 2005, called Crow. And since about 2012, around the same time as this series, I've been doing these very small scale crows. They're all small. They're all smaller than an actual crow. They're all in oil paint, usually a lot more thickly painted than my normal paintings. And they're based on photos, not from albums, but photos that I'll take on my iPhone. So you usually get a little silhouette, just a shape of a crow. So you can really invent them for the paintings. And essentially, the director of the Icon Gallery visited this show, The Sun Never Sets, in its first iteration in Huddersfield Art Gallery with me in August. And, you know, obviously, their main gallery has been programmed 2-3 years in advance. And he thought, I love your crows. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could do a sort of building takeover for a couple of months while you have the show on at the MAC? And it was inspired because essentially from the moment you get to the front entrance of the Icon Gallery, there's a crow posted just by the door, you know, just out of reach, just, you know, as crows are, they're just around. And we've actually fitted 39 crows, over three dozen crows, around the ground floor of the gallery. And they're, you know, all the way up to the entrance to the toilets, you can spot crows sort of ominously watching you. There's something sinister about them. And it was a joy to install and put them in.
Excellent. Now, there are two pieces of work which are on loan from the Arts Council Collection and the South Bank Centre in London. We'll talk about those now. Matthew, let's start with this first piece, which is called Skeleton, and you referred to it earlier on as a fairly important piece, I think.
That's right. It was one of the first large-scale ones that I wanted to make as part of this series, and at the time it was the biggest painting I'd made. It's, 2 meters by 1.5 meter, 2 meters wide, 1.5 meters tall, and it's in the center of it. It's got the two boys, and they're standing in something of a confrontational pose, both in shorts and t-shirts, and they're wearing flip-flops. But then, right in front of them, you know, literally a few centimeters away from their feet, there's this massive 2 meter-long carcass. And it's got back legs and it's got horns, but it's missing front legs. So often, like, children will come in and they'll say, is it a dinosaur? Is it a kangaroo? But in fact, it was the skeleton of a cow. And this we came across beside a river in a place called Mymensingh in Bangladesh. And there'd been some terrible floods. This is in 1988. And there were some really, like, internationally known about floods in Bangladesh. And so you can imagine the scene that my brother and I came across, which was carcass after carcass after carcass of cattle, which had been washed off from local farms and then drowned and washed up on the banks of this river. And there were vultures everywhere pecking at the bones. And my brother and I, being the type we were, you know, we took back like a skull and some bones. And so I had this really vivid sense of it. But you see in the background there are palm trees. It's a really lush scene. But the skeleton itself, it's kind of dripping paint, almost like the decay of a body into the earth. And the whole thing has that sense of youth, death and life all in it.
First time I saw this painting, I thought two things. I thought, one, there's a sense of fear about it. Like, you know, there's two young lads who've discovered something they don't know whether they should have, or perhaps they should be there in the first place. But then there's pride. You mentioned the kind of confrontational sort of, you know, stance. There's an element of, look what we found, you know, it's that kind of mix.
Absolutely, and a lot of my paintings are about the gaze of the people in the picture, where they're looking directly at you or looking away from you, and both these boys are looking directly out at you, but you can't fully make out their eyes. It's more like the shadows of their eye sockets. And there's something as well in their poses. The older boy, that's my older brother, has his arms sort of crossed around him in quite a casual way. And there's this sense of, yeah, almost like bravado, I guess, particularly in the older one's stance.
Let's move on to the other piece that's on loan from Arts Council and South Bank Centre. This one is called, I think, The Ordination. Is that right?
That's right. It's called Ordination. Often I like just a simple one-word title. It's the last thing that I give to a painting. And it's a painting of, in fact, 14 people in total. It's got 8 adults and 6 children, 3 girls on one side, 3 boys on the other side. And it's set up partly inspired by, you know, old master paintings, you know, in terms of the compositions, which would often be a religious scene with lots of people in some kind of arrangement. And I spent a lot of time working out exactly where the people would go. And also their expressions. In the very center, underneath a cross, there's a European man. He's got a particularly pink kind of face and skin, standing out from all the others who are of Bangladeshi origin. And that European man, for me as a viewer, just looks slightly odd, slightly out of place. And he's actually leaning over. He's dressed in a cassock and religious robes, and he's leaning over another man who's kneeling in front of him, holding a book, we assume a Bible, and lifting him up in a way as if to ordain him. And for me, this painting is quite complex because it's about race in a way, and it's also about the history of, you know, missionaries. But there is also this sense of everyone working together. It's also one man in a way caressing another, sort of, you know, bringing him into the church, ordaining him. And they're all dressed up. And for me, you see, this is the kind of constructed role play of the adult world, which then you've got in contrast to those two boys and that raw outdoor experience with the skeleton. And that's why they're also very near each other as well. They don't just exist in isolation. There's meant to be a dialogue between them. And of course, the other thing that stitches it all together is that man's my father as well, who is the priest of the Church of Bangladesh.
Well, the exhibition The Sun Never Sets is here on the first floor gallery at MAC till the 10th of March. So folks can come in for free and have a look around at your amazing pieces of art. They can also go to the Icon Gallery in Birmingham and see The Murder of Crows in the same time span, as it were.
And also there's going to be one of my paintings called Boy and Mask at Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery from the 26th of January until May. And that's another work in the Arts Council collection, which has been selected by an artist called Rachel McLean, who curates a show called Too Cute, Sweet is About to Become Sinister. So that's as well going to be on at the same time as these two shows.
Matthew, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks thanks for your time. Thanks for showing me around.
Great. Thanks very much, James.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
There'll be an artist talk and tour on Thursday, the 21st of February at 6 p.m. in the gallery at MAC Birmingham. The exhibition runs until the 10th of March, and more information can be found at macbirmingham.co.uk. You're listening to the New Curiosities Box, and I'm James Sandy. Folk singer Martin Joseph is a man with a long career of heartfelt, authentic storytelling. On the cusp of a new album and forging new ground in music as a campaigning platform, I caught up with Martin as he took a breather during his recent sold-out show at MAC Birmingham. So I'm really lucky we're going to have some wise words now with Martin Joseph, and his fans will hopefully pick up on that reference. But Martin, it's good to talk to you.
Thanks, James. Nice to be on your show.
You're playing the MAC tonight, and I want to talk to you about your new album. Mm-hmm. It's very new. In fact, it's soon to be released.
January 25th, officially, yeah.
So it's called Here Come the Young, okay, which you're a young man yourself. I mean, you're only touching early 40s, I'm sure.
58.
Tell me a bit about the kind of the driving concept of that.
I sing a lot of, I'm known for some of my social, semi-political songs as such, and so I guess the theme of the record is no exception, though the album is a collective of both the personal and the political. I'm not a sort of a political singer as such, but it always bleeds in. So there's personal material on there too. But Here Come the Young was an observation after the snap election 2017, where a lot of young people had the chance to vote for the first time, and I think they were dismayed by the Brexit vote, etc. And so their voices were really heard. And then we had in America, after another one of those crazy shootings, there was a big lobby of young people saying, well, we want our voices heard about this issue. And so they began to march and all the rest of it. And observing my own three kids, who are now all in their 20s, well, one's 30 now, and just observing their view on life. And I don't think that, every generation carries its own baggage, and I'm no doubt that they will have theirs as such, but certainly issues like LGBT rights and things that were an issue for my father's generation and some of my generation, it's not a problem, you know? And so they seem to be, I would say, more open, more inclusive, more loving. That gets passed down through the generations, but the thing is that they can try to disregard some aspects of that haven't been so good. And so I'm buoyed by the fact that I at least see some of the issues that have been historic issues, such as Northern Ireland, for instance. You know, it needed literally a new generation to come along and end that hatred and that bigotry. And I think that's happened there. So I look at that with hope, hence the theme of the song, Here Come the Young. Yeah.
Now this, I believe, is your 33rd studio album, is that right?
It's not my 33rd, it's about my 20th studio record, and the rest are sort of best ofs and a lot of live records and little collaborations and things.
But you're a hard-working man, I deduce from that.
I work hard, James, yeah, I do. I play, you know, it's over 130, 140 shows a year, and I've already alluded to my age, so, you know, and I don't fly around on a private jet or anything, so it's, you know, I do, I travel a lot, and I put everything into performance, and having said that, there's not an ounce of me that's really complaining, because I love what I do, and always will do, and the truth is, I'm rubbish at everything else, so it better last.
You mentioned some of the rock and roll razzmatazz that you get thrown into. You mentioned Runcorn was a
yes, there you go.
So, you know, yeah. you do get all the high points, I think.
Well, you know, I mean, Runcorn was very nice, but yeah, it's not... it's, you know, the guitar has been not only my chief therapist, but it's been the ticket to travel around the world, and that has opened me up to, it changed me. I saw things that really have changed me, you know, that I wouldn't have had the chance perhaps to see back home where I came from in Cardiff. So it's amazing, and so, but yeah, you know, the travel bit is tough, but it's part of the job. People aren't going to turn up on my doorstep and say, "Hey, sing me a song, and here's the money." You know, you gotta go find them. And I'm really not complaining.
Here come the young, with open minds and heart, inclusive from the start. Here come the young. Here come the young, they might just save the day. You best get out the way. Here come the young, tired of all your fighting, tired of all these years, tired of blazing crosses, tired of narrow feet, tired of smelling hunger, and they're tired of hearing lies, and they're tired of the big divide. These tired girls and boys, here come the young, with open minds and hearts, inclusive from the start. Here come the young, here come the young. Might just save the day, best get out the way. Here come the young, tired of assassinations, tired of military threats, tired of the talk of trickle down, and they're tired of crippling debt, tired of corporations, tired of broken trust, tired of being slaughtered, and then dreams that turn to rust. Here come the young, with open minds and hearts, inclusive from the start. Here come the young, here come the young, and they might just save the day. You best get out the way, here come the young. Rising oceans, tired of bigotry, tired of racist leaders, eroding liberty, and they're tired of a lack of shame, and they're tired of failed accord, and colluders in a private game, and tired of law ignored, and they're tired of their future being taken from them now. So you better watch your back, sir, 'cause they're coming for you now. Here come the young, open minds and hearts, inclusive from the start. Here come the young, here come the young, and they might just save the day, and you best get out of the way. Here come the young, here come the young, with open minds and hearts, inclusive from the start. Here come the young, here come the young, and they might just save the day, and you best get out the way. Here come the young.
Now, you mentioned politics, and indeed most, I guess, folk music has an edge to politics, has a strand of politics running.
Well, it used to. In its roots, it did. In its heyday, you know, if you look at, you look at Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and that, you know, it started out from this sort of civil rights political base. And sometimes I think we've, you know, folk music itself might have lost its voice in that a little bit. There's a lot of people out there doing it, but you don't perhaps hear about them. But often I go to folk conventions or at folk festivals, and I find it a little bit disappointing sometimes. Just the context of what people are singing about sometimes there's not a great deal of difference, it seems to me, as the sort of top 40 material sometimes in terms of its sort of it's a bit me, you know.
So how is this record different in terms of when I listen to it? It's definitely a Martin Joseph record. Mm-hmm. It's clearly you, but how do you say it's different in terms of its sound or its feel?
I worked with a guy called Jerry Diver. He was recommended to me by Tom Robinson, who made a record with Jerry. And Jerry has a unique way of working. And I said to him, I really want you to, you know, make an edgy record for me, because we play live and the thing is, you know, there's this great sort of, anything can happen, and it's very live and happening. And I make records and, you know, I'm happy with them, but at the time, but then they just lack a little bit of luster of what happens in that edge, you know. So Jerry got me, I went up to his studio and I would sing my bit. I would just get the performance we needed, even if it took 20 takes or whatever. And then he sends me home. And then a few days later, I get through three or four different ways of where this thing can go. You know, you can push up on the faders. And I was thinking, oh, I don't like that. And then I'd go back and 10 minutes later, I would say, actually, I love that. That's amazing. And if I'd been in the studio, I would have said, no, I don't, you know, and I would have stopped him. So it gave him the freedom to do what he thought and then gave me the chance to live with it. And the result is, I think, it's the edgiest sort of studio recording I've probably made. It's really in your face and sounds good. And as a result, radio is being very kind. So, you know, seems to prove the point.
And there's some family input as well, isn't there? I think your daughter, Harriet, is on the record.
She is indeed. She sings on the chorus of Here Come the Young. And she does some backing vocals on the last song, Collateral. She's got a band of her own called Mellow Gang. They're doing really well in London, and kind of a psychedelic pop outfit she's in. And she got a degree in music, which I never would have done. And it's great to keep it in the family a little bit there. Yeah. And my son Stefan designed the album cover, so there you go.
That was full circle, isn't it? So,
yeah.
Tell me about Love's Majority. That's a really interesting song from the album.
Well, it's about, for me, you know, despite the negativity and the fear and all the cynicism that we hear, or rather all the noise that we hear, makes us feel those things, I think. You know, so people begin to pull down the shutters and claim territory, and it's very divisive, everything that's going on in America and Britain right now. But I firmly believe that the vast majority of people across the planet are good at their heart and wake up every day and try to do the right thing. So it's a chorus saying that, we will never give up. We will never give in to that dark message, and that love will always, always shine through in the end, and we'll win the day.
So. It reminded me of the Leonard Cohen lyric.
Oh, thank you.
Well, that love is the only engine of survival.
Oh, that's a beautiful line, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a very, very strong message.
You won't find the silence of Love's Majority. You can do anything you like, but and it does. You know, people, the most horrific things happen, but the next day, in come the masses of people, you know, whether it be candles, flowers, whatever it might be, to show that this is not who we are. God, there's some evil in this world. Just when you think you've seen it all, lightning strikes and shakes down everything you thought was standing firm and beautiful and tall. We're not just straining for the echo of all the vision we hold dear. We're looking for the common threads of love that bind us truly human. Shalom and Shalom. You can shoot us, lynch us, high
Run us down, you don't get far. You can board up every window to all the light there'll ever be. You won't find the silence of love's maturity. We are a chorus of many voices to the stars from the roof. From the shoreline we stand ready and we shall not move. So amen, shanti, shalom and shalom. You can shoot us, lynch us high, run us down, you don't get far. You can board up every window to all the light there'll ever be. You won't find the silence of love's majority. You've seen it all. One brief and shining moment can rinse the soul. Amen, shanti, shalom and shalom. You can shoot us, lynch us high, run us down, you don't get far. You can board up every window to all the light there'll ever be. You won't find the silence of love's charity.
Now, to build on that, one of the many things you do, and it, I suppose it's sort of obviously artistically linked, but your charity, your trust that you've set up, which is called Let Yourself Trust.
Yeah.
It's a clever play on words, I think.
Yeah, it's a song I've got called Let Yourself, yeah. I've always hooked up with small organisations with my music and tried to, you know, give them a little hand up if I could. Not that I, you know, I play to hundreds of people, not thousands. I don't have wide influence or anything, but I was able to draw people's attention to some of these things that I found amazing, you know, husband and wives or individuals or communities that saw something that they were trying to put right, but they never got the funding, you know. And, you know, there's some beautiful, massive organizations out there doing great work, but we also hear about a lot of money squandered. And but these people don't waste a penny because they're, you know, they're so committed. So we fundraise for an organization for 6 months. We give them publicity from the stage and through our avenues, and then we give them a check. We've actually raised about $250,000 in 5 years and given it away, which is astonishing. But that's only thanks to my audience. You know, you build up this trust with people. And we change every 6 months. So we've got a nice portfolio. We're on to our 11th project now. And we keep circling back and we take volunteer trips to people to show them this stuff. And I'm taking other artists so that they can see that they might hopefully write about those things and tell their audience. So it's an interesting thing. We're still growing, still working with it. But the results so far have been amazing.
I think it's a great platform. And I think it's something, as you mentioned earlier, that other people could...
I think so, James. Yeah, I do. And, I've taken some artists over, you know, like people like Grace Petrie and Sam Kelly from the UK, kind of folky political singers. And, you know, and we've taken them to the West Bank in Palestine and to Guatemala. And just with no agenda, I'm not saying they have to do anything, but I just want them to see things, to open, you know, their thoughts up a little bit further so that they might be able to... I don't know, they'll plant their own seeds, but it's just a chance. Because the guitar gave me, as I said earlier in our interview, it gave me the chance to see so many things. And I think that's education is everything. If you can show someone something, it can change their life.
Well, you are a hardworking man, as I've said a couple of times, so you can put that on your CV. You're touring, you're doing London, Southampton, Cardiff, Shrewsbury, Shropshire, Anglesey, But you're also you're doing some festivals, I think, in Shropshire and Shrewsbury. But you're also doing Canada, US, and Germany as well.
Yeah, we started this UK tour actually last year in October, and so we're running. So it's about 34 dates, and then that will end. We go to Germany for 10, and then America and Canada. I love going to Canada, especially. I've always enjoyed touring there. I'm really blessed. There's so many people out there playing these days, and people are struggling to make that meet, but I've just built this audience up over 30 odd years that keep coming and pay my bills, and I can go out there and do what I love.
And just finally, I wanted to ask you about how you were very nearly a Brummie yourself.
That's my story tonight. Well, yeah, I was just saying that when I was a kid, about 8 years old, I remember Dad on holiday somewhere. He worked for a brewery, and he had the chance to come from Cardiff to Birmingham on a big promotion. And one night he probably had a few glasses of wine, but he sat me down and said, "What do you think I should do, son?" And obviously I'm 8 years old, I don't want to go anywhere. So I said, "Oh, I think we should stay here, Dad." And so we did. Sorry, Birmingham. Love to visit, though.
Martin, best of luck on the rest of the tour.
Pleasure, James.
It's been great to have a chat with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
For more on new album Here Come the Young and information on gigs and projects, go to www.martinjoseph.net. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Dan Whitehouse, Matthew Krishnu, Mac Birmingham, Martin Joseph, and Pipe Records. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.